The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year. It's a particularly extraordinary year for us at Women of the Year because it's our 70th anniversary. So in celebration, we're doing something a bit different in this series of the podcast. Every woman who's invited to the Women of the Year lunch is extraordinary in some way. And we've been lucky enough to talk to some of them in the previous three series of The Extraordinary Ordinary. But back in 2000, it was decided to give awards to a small number of standout women at each lunch in recognition of their exceptional achievements, courage, and or legacy, or indeed all three. Since then, we've honoured over 100 amazing women, including Tina Turner, Margaret Thatcher, P.D. James, and Marie Colvin. But it hasn't just been about the famous names. We've also given awards to many extraordinary, ordinary women who've shown remarkable determination, bravery, tenacity, and courage, often in the most difficult and dangerous of situations. I'm Diane Kenwood, journalist, broadcaster, and a director of Women of the Year. And in this anniversary series, I'll be talking to some of those amazing past award winners to share why they were honoured, what it meant to them at the time, and to find out how life has been for them since becoming a Woman of the Year award winner. So it would be fair to say that a great deal has happened in the life of this episode's award-winning guest. Since Jasvinda Sangera was given the Women of the Year Window on the World Award in 2007, in recognition of her unwavering campaigning for the rights of victims of forced marriage, domestic violence, and honour killings, she's brought about a groundbreaking change in the law, been awarded a CBE, and was made a dame in the King's Birthday Honours List this year. It's all a far cry from her strict upbringing and the arranged marriage to a stranger in India she was informed about at the age of 14. Running away from home at 16, Jasvinda lost everything she'd ever known, and her family, her parents, six sisters and one brother, severed ties with her completely. The challenges and heartbreaking tragedy she experienced subsequently only cemented her determination to help others facing the same injustices and cruelty. Jasvinda, welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary. It's fantastic to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'd quite like to start, aside from saying many, many congratulations on the amazing honour this year. That's quite fantastic. And we will definitely get some conversation around that in due course. But to begin, I'd really like to go right back to the early days, and perhaps you could paint a picture for us of your life as a child and what it was like growing up in your family.
Sure. I think I need to start at the beginning in terms of the history of my family, because for people listening to this, they need to understand that that was critical to my life experiences. So my father came to England in the late 1950s in search of work, invited by UK government. He came from the Punjab in India, did not speak a word of English, and came here with the vision of creating a life for himself, his children. My mother was left behind. The men normally came first. And he came here, settled, then my mother came along, and we were born here. So I'm one of seven sisters, and I have one brother. So we were born in England, and we went to school in England. And by the age of six, I understood the role of a girl as being very different to the role of a boy. I based that on having one brother, but equally looking around me and seeing the role of men. So we were allowed to be seen, but not heard. We could not go into a room where there were boys or men. And as I got older, 9, 10, 11, 12, the adolescent years, we became young girls who were taught to cook, clean. My mother would say, you don't need an education because one day, like me, you're going to become somebody's wife. So there wasn't an importance placed on being an individual, a thinker. You were very much a girl, and a girl's role was to be submissive, was to become a future wife. It was not to think, it was to be told. And you couldn't speak. So I learned that very, very quickly. And I remember my family is Sikh, Indian Sikh. And, you know, we eat all the Indian food, but I was raised with it. And chapatis had to be round. My mother would say to me, if you don't make a ranch patty, you cannot marry a decent boy. So I'd always deliberately make mine square because I thought if I don't, then I won't have to get married. So I have one sister younger than me, and I watched my sisters being taken out of British schools at the age of 15 to marry men. They'd only ever met in photographs. They'd go to India, disappear for about 9 months to a year, and come back as somebody's wife. And nobody said anything about it. And neither did they protest. They never said no. And when it was my turn, I came home from school at the age of 14. My mother sat me down, very jovial, and presented me with a photograph of a man who I was to learn at the age of 14 that I was promised to him at the age of 8. And I remember looking at this picture and thinking, he's shorter than me. He's older than me. I want to do my homework. That's all I was thinking. And I dared to voice what I was thinking to my mother. And I'd never seen any of my sisters do this before. And I said, no, I'm not marrying him. I want to go to school. I want to get an education. Dare I say, go to college or even university. My mother came straight back and was very clear that I was promised to this man. And the promise of a marriage is a really important thing. To dishonour that promise is shame upon the family. So I would not dishonour this family by saying no. So I went back to school the next day, knowing that I'm engaged, not telling a teacher, not daring to tell a teacher because of the fear of the repercussions, because I was raised to be silent. Speaking outside the family carries a punishment, so you don't do it. And tried to be normal. And at the age of 15 and a half, I really protested. I'm not marrying this man.
What do you think drove you to come back at this expectation in a way that none of your other siblings did?
That's a really important question, because people say, why you out of seven sisters? And, you know, you're the one that left home and ran away. For me, I think the importance of age is really critical here. So I have one sister younger than me, and I watched my other sisters going into these marriages, and they suffered the most horrific marriages. The domestic abuse was horrendous, but nobody went to save them and protect them. I would watch my mother and the community go to the house of where my sister was with her bruises and encourage her to stay. My mother would say, when your husband gets angry, your job as a woman is to think of it like a pan of boiling milk. A pan of boiling milk boils to the top, and the woman's role is to blow on it and to make it go down, no matter how much he harms you. So for me, I thought that was marriage.
I just wonder if we could understand how on earth you managed the disparity between your day-to-day life as a teenager in a school and the day-to-day life of you as an supposedly obedient Indian daughter at home.
There are two lives in the life of a person who is trying to straddle two cultures, I suppose. The one I was born in, which is Britain, that is a democracy where you have the right to have freedom, independence, the right to be educated, etc. And then the other life is the one where you are raised within a family dynamic, whereby all those things, in terms of what it means to be free, are wrong, and you are taught they are wrong. So you are conditioned to believe they are wrong. And then you are also made to believe that if you overstep that line, you will be punished. Now, the greater of the two is the home life, actually. And you have to remember that at that time, in the very early 70s and 80s, there was no awareness about this. So the people with power were parents. So if I were to speak to the teachers, they would have gone home and they would have believed my parents, not me. So you learn to navigate yourself. And the way you do it is to navigate yourself in a way whereby you are living two lives almost, one in full view of your family in terms of conforming. And if you dare, you live another world in terms of a very secret life. So, you know, in terms of having a secret boyfriend, putting your makeup on in the school's toilets and then taking it off before you go home, you know, daring to do things, but ensuring that the family never found out.
So obviously for you, this sort of clash of cultures and expectations reached a crisis point, and you took the incredibly brave step of leaving home at the extraordinarily young age of 16. That must have been absolutely terrifying, wasn't it?
I suppose at the time, I just knew I did not want to marry this stranger. I pleaded with my mother, my father, even my sisters, who said, well, we had to do it. Why are you any different? You know, so I just knew there was no way out. Of course, I agreed to the marriage because then that enabled me to plan an escape. And at that point, I had to play the part. I always describe it as having a bird's eye view, looking down on these wedding preparations and having to take part. You know, your wedding day is meant to be one of the happiest days of your life. You know, I had to act out the role of pretending all the while I was planning my escape. My biggest fear was my family finding out that I was planning an escape. So, yeah, I was scared, but the fear wasn't enough to stop me from running away from home. I knew that if I married this man, my life would be over.
Did you fully understand what the consequences of doing that would be?
I don't think I did. As a 15-year-old, no. I just knew that as a very naive 15-year-old at the time, who'd never kissed a boy, who'd never even been allowed to look at a boy because that was shameful and you'd get in trouble, I just knew I didn't want to be with somebody in that way. And what compelled me was seeing what was happening to my sisters. So I suppose the severity of the fear and the impact, etc., as I've got older, I recognise it now. But at that time, as an adolescent teenager, I just wanted to run to get away from it.
That probably is what literally saved you then at that stage. If you had truly understood the ramifications and the consequences, it may have stopped you and your life would have taken a very different course. As it was, what happened was that your family literally cut you off, didn't they?
Absolutely. I never expected that. I ran away from home to make the point that I was born here in the UK and I should have the right to choose who I want to marry, if indeed I do in the future. I should certainly have the right to an education. I hoped with all my might that when I made that call home to say, I want to come back, but I don't want to marry that man, that my mother — I refer to my mother a lot because my mother was the key person that upheld these practices, that enforced discipline infringement — that she would say, okay, you've made your point, come back. But she didn't. It was, you either come home and marry this man, or from this day forward, you are dead in our eyes. And I never, ever expected that. I'm 58 years old now, and I'm still disowned by my family. It's been almost 44 years. Not only am I disowned, I have three children and three grandchildren. For their grandmother, it's a total blank. I don't regret that decision. We could talk more about that later. But the point here is that was something that absolutely plagued my life.
How did you manage to pull together a life for yourself from such an incredibly young age and with no support?
Well, my best friend was an Indian girl. I wasn't not allowed white friends because my mother always said the worst insult you can bring to our front door is that you are behaving like a white woman. And what she was basically saying was integration was not allowed. You know, you cannot integrate because you'll have their ideas, you know, freedom, independence, rights, etc. So my best friend was Indian, and I told her my plight, and she was going through the same thing. But I was allowed to go to her house because she was Indian. And it was actually her brother that helped me. And I told him, and he was 6 years older than me, and he said he would help me. Now, that was a risk because it was a friend that I knew very well, my best friend, not the brother, but we got to know each other. And he actually became my first secret boyfriend in the end. And he helped me run away from home. And I have to say that the vulnerability is immense. Any teenager out there in the world, for me, it was a million times that, because when people talk about living under a bus shelter and being raised in that way, it was like that for me. we were not allowed to think outside our family. As soon as school was over, we go home, we had to wear traditional dress. I'd never been to town on my own city centre. You know, you couldn't look at boys. So being thrown into the big world, you are immensely vulnerable. Vulnerability is a gift in the hands of the person you choose to trust. And he protected me and cared for me and did not take advantage of that. But anybody else could have. So he helped me along that way.
You obviously had to battle your own mental health demons in your fight to right yourself on your feet and find your place in the world.
Absolutely. And I attempted to take my life when I was 15 years old because I thought that would be the thing my mother would realise. Look, she's trying to take her life. She's serious. She doesn't want to marry this man. They didn't take any notice. I took an overdose and I wasn't allowed to go to the hospital. I was just given lots of coffee and told to walk up and down. And when I ran away at the age of 16, I attempted to take my life again at the age of 17 because I miss my family so much. And I felt that I'd done this to them. I felt like I was the bad person. And, you know, you go to the GP and you try and talk about things and they throw antidepressants at you. But for me, you have to remember, I'm an Indian Sikh young girl. In our Punjabi language, we don't even have a word for mental health. I was taught to be silent. So you're talking therapies, I'm not hearing that because I'm not allowed to do that. So you don't just shed everything you've learned straight away. That takes time. I can honestly say that it wasn't until I stepped down as the Chief Executive Officer of Carmen of Honor after 25 years in 2018, and I had the time to be silent, that I recognised that I had had a traumatic event happen in my life.
Yeah, but there was trauma on trauma, wasn't there? Because although you had no contact with your family, you did discover that something terrible had happened to your older sister, Abina. Can you talk us through the memories of that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things about being disowned, estranged from family members, sometimes you do have secret relationships with family members, and Rubina was one of them. She was a year and a half older than me. You know, we shared a bed together, we went to school together, etc. And Rubina suffered a horrific marriage. And she used to tell me, in fact, when I used to see her in Leicester in secret, my mother and father never knew this, she would have bruises. I would see the visible marks in her house of broken windows, punctures in the walls, etc. And I would say to her, leave him, come to me, I will protect you. Because of course I always knew what my parents' response would be. And back then in my early 20s, I was a market trader in Leeds on market stalls. And this woman came to me, you need to ring home, she said. She knew my family really well. Something terrible has happened to your sister. So I rang home. And this would be the second time I've spoken to my mother. First time, of course, was at 16 when she disowned me. This would be the second time. I said, Mum, what's happened? She says, it's Rubina. I said, what do you mean, Rubina? She said, she's died. She's dead. I said, what do you mean, died dead? I'd seen her just a week ago. What do you mean? She says, she set herself on fire and she's committed suicide. And I remember saying to my mother, the immediate response was, I'm coming. I'll come to the house. You know, the grief is raw. You want to go to your family and be with people. And she was very clear. You must not come here. But I know you, you will come. So you can come when it's dark and nobody can see your face. And I thought, even now, you've lost the daughter in such a horrific way. You're still telling me to stay away because of what people might think. And for me, that was the turning point. That was the day when I let go of waiting for them to accept me, of waiting for them to love me. That was my turning point. Because if this doesn't change anything, because she's not coming back, Rubina's not coming back. And it was then that I made the decision to speak out and to develop the charity that is Carmen of Honour.
So you decided that you needed to take some action, that you wanted to do something to confront the situation and potentially help other people so that, you know, what happened to your sister, the terrible thing that happened to her, wouldn't happen to anyone else. But you didn't do it straight away. You felt you wanted to wait until your parents had died. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My mother's health deteriorated as soon as Robina died. Within, you know, a year, she got very ill. You know, within 18 months, she had cancer, and then she passed away, and her dying words were in Punjabi, "Robina, I'm coming to you." I felt it wouldn't be fair for my parents while alive to hear me speaking out against these abusers, because they were only doing what they thought was best. And that's not me saying it's okay. I felt I didn't want to hurt them. I love my parents. I always have. That, you know, I've no anger towards them at all. But it wouldn't have been fair. And also, my father and my mother, even at that time, more so now, I see them as victims themselves. So yes, I waited until my father passed away, actually.
So it was then you created your charity, Karma Nirvana, and initially it was a helpline, wasn't it? Mm. Didn't get media to pick up, did it? I think there was quite a long period of time when absolutely nobody rang the helpline at all.
Absolutely. And nobody wanted to know either. In 93, they used to see me, this, what is this woman talking about? You know, this doesn't happen in England. There's no evidence. And I'd always say, I'm the statistic, so is Robina, and I'll talk to our experiences. And then you had the issue of Jaswinder, you need to go and work with the communities. Well, the communities where this is happening didn't want to know me. And so the help plan that started in my front room, we didn't get any calls for the first 5 years, but I always believed that they were out there. They just didn't know we were here. So the more awareness raising that we did, the more likely they would come to the helpline. And the way I did it was, I went to Indian community centres, Pakistani community centres, Bangladeshi community centres, and I taught myself to become a Keatfoot instructor. And I used to teach classes, and these women would come, and at the end of the class, I'd say, let me tell you about this women's health project. So I never told them what we were really about. And then I would say, we're about, you know, menopause and breast cancer. And the very first event I ever did was called Women's Health Day. But the point here is the women would come out and they would start to share what was happening in their lives. And as soon as that door opened, I'd walk through it and then have different conversations. And that's how we evolved.
Did you meet resistance from the community, though? I mean, once it was clear what you were doing and once the charity did start to gain some traction and, you know, these women did open up the doors to you, was there a lot of pushback from particularly the men in the community, for example?
Absolutely. The negativity in terms of not just the community, but professionals who would say to me, we want to help you, but, you know, we don't want to offend people. But then in terms of the direct threats, threats to life, I remember getting off a train once from London and the threat was there was a bomb under my car and being met by police. My children were very little then. And then being taught to look for bombs under my car, and they expected me to do that on the school run every morning. And I used to get up at 5 o'clock in this long stick with a mirror, and I didn't want my children to see that, having panic alarms in my house. You know, nasty letters, human faeces smeared all over my car, all sorts of things. But over time, what happened was the more people started to talk about this, the less I felt threatened, I felt safer. Because Jaswinder was this woman, she was one woman back in 93, nobody was talking about this. So their job was to silence me.
How important was it to you to receive an award like you did from Women of the Year and the opportunity it gave you to raise something that a lot of the women in the room may not have even at that stage been aware of? I mean, this was 2007, so the charity had been going for a while.
Gosh, it was immensely important because it wasn't only about recognising me and the work that I'd done, you're recognising this important issue. And whatever award you receive, for me, it's what will it do for the campaign? So from that perspective, it's so important. It was so significant. I remember receiving it and I was given the privilege of being able to say a few words, and I read from my book. I remember it. I read from my book. I wanted people to hear how it felt to hear those words from my mother in terms of "you're dead in our eyes." And the point here is it made me feel supported. It made me feel that the mission and the purpose, it's worthwhile, because you're not on your own. And then in that room, you start networking and talking to people and you meet like minds. And that's so important. So in terms of the award at that time in my journey, it was important for me as an individual, because every day you are campaigning, you have knockbacks. Self-belief is really important as well. Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes, you know, that quiet voice at the end of the day is saying, you're not going to achieve this, you're not going to do this, there's too many people against you. The fact that this was recognizing not just me and what I'd done, but the actual issue, it took the course to another level. And that was what I absolutely used to the max. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Women of the World has helped us to reach more people.
Well, there you go. You have just perfectly summarized exactly why we love being able to recognize people like you at Women of the Year, really. It's so important. I'm going to leap forward quite a lot, because it's been 17 years since you got your award. And to ask you to summarize what's happened in those 17 years is a brutally difficult thing to do, I know, because there's been a lot. But what for you have been the sort of highlights of what you've managed to do in that time, bearing in mind it was in the still relatively early days of Karma Nirvana and all your very high-profile campaigning?
One of the most significant achievements for me will always be taking an issue that nobody was reporting. You know, my 5 years of a helpline and waiting for it to ring, but always believing they were there, to developing a national helpline that is now funded by the Home Office. It was when I left, it still is. When I left in 2018, it had received over 150,000 calls for support. The fact that you've reached so many people, for me, that's a huge achievement. The fact that I remember the days of not getting more than two people to hear what I had to say in a room. And I was deeply thankful for that, for the two people. I would show up, they would show up. And that's great. But now people are showing up. People are taking this issue upon themselves. You have police forces that have got forced marriage units. You know, you have social workers that are trained in this. So all 43 police forces have been inspected. So that's a huge, you know, people are interested in doing this. So from my perspective, the fact that this issue has gone from not being talked about to into the public domain, and actually embedded into policy and practice. The civil and criminal law, I campaigned for 13 years for a criminal offence. Two governments wouldn't criminalise it, but I still continued. You know, I believe this was necessary, because I could never say to my mother at the age of 14, you can't do this to me, it's against the law. Karma Nirvana now tell me, this is not just about prosecutions, this is about shifting attitudes. You know, this is not cultural. This is abuse. They tell me that they're hearing more and more young people able to negotiate with their parents, because their parents were able to say to those people in those countries abroad, we don't want to go to jail. You know, so the fact that we have civil criminal law, and this year, Karma Nirvana have achieved an outcome of increasing the age of marriage for children and young people in this country, in England and Wales, from 16 into 18. I've been working on that for years. The legacy is continuing, and it's just amazing to know that you've done something, you've stepped back as a founder, but it's still continuing.
And the fact that you have stepped back as a founder doesn't mean you've stopped your campaigning, does it?
No, not at all. There's all been doing all sorts of things, what can I say?
And I'm glad that, you know, you are also having some time a bit more for yourself now. And I hope that that is enabling you to get some perspective on the astonishing things that you've achieved in your lifetime so far. And I'm sure there are more to come. And we all at Women of the Year are really delighted to have played a very small part in shining a spotlight on you and the amazing work you've done. So thank you. And thank you for such a powerfully honest conversation. It's been absolutely fantastic. But it's not quite over, because I still have to ask you the four questions we ask all our guests on The Extraordinary Ordinary. So we'll kick off with the first one, which is, tell me who is or are the woman or women who've inspired you in your life.
There are two women, actually. The first one has to be Maya Angelou. The reason why is because I came into education very late in my life. I did not read a book until I was 27 years old. And then I did my A-levels very discreetly. And that was the book that we had to study. And sometimes it is said that you don't choose a book, the book chooses you. And I understand that. So the book was I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And reading that, I remember thinking, wow, even a bird in a cage has the ability to sing. That's what she's saying. It is her autobiography. So the caged bird recognizes it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for representing how any restriction that on a man or a woman might have in his or her life, you can still sing for freedom from oppression and abuse. And it directly spoke to me in my experience, because nobody had ever told me that. You know, I'd never heard that. So it has to be that, because it opened my mind to the possibility of hope, the possibility of being free. Even as I'm talking to you right now, I have to say, I do not take my independence for granted. Nobody gave it me. I had to fight for that. So she inspires me, because no matter the bars that restrict you, we all have the capacity of choice if we really want it. So that would be why. And I think the second one, and I haven't come to this until later in my life, is my mother. I could never stand up anymore and say my mother was a key perpetrator in my life, which I did for 25 years when I was raising awareness. I would never say that again. And I say that because I recognize now in my older self the sacrifices my mother made. She came to this country in the late 50s into a whole new world. This was a woman that didn't speak English, that only knew India, that gave birth to two of her children in a field in India, who feared hospitals, and she was planted here. And her life and what she did here was doing what she thought was best for us. That would have been bloody hard, raising children and the community around you, putting all these expectations on you. I understand her differently now. And the grief that I remember women coming round and saying to her, oh gosh, what have you done in your previous life to give birth to seven daughters? You know, that's how they would look at her and how she must have felt. So I'm inspired by my mother's courage, her strength, albeit she was the one that hurt me the most. I get it and I understand it. And for me, she is an inspiration, and I never got to tell her that, but I can say it now publicly.
You never got to tell your mother, but if you had the chance now to tell your younger self something, what would your advice to your younger self be? That's maybe 14 or 16-year-old girl.
For me, it would to say, it's not your fault. Don't feel responsible for other people's neglect. You are responsible for your own peace of mind. But having family, being family, is not an excuse for being treated less than you deserve. I believed I was a perpetrator from the age of 15 to the age of 21. When I gave birth to my own daughter, they made me feel that I'd done this to them. So I would say, remind yourself, it is not your fault, that you have to move away from pleasing others and you have to hold yourself to account and know that you are right in this. That's what I would say.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Tell me now, what is the one thing you can't live without?
I had to really think about that. And then the obvious ones were water, oxygen and food. Yeah. That's how logical my brain went. But for me, that the fundamental human emotion that brings you joy and fulfillment, and most of all, connection, is love. And I say that because I have had to learn to live my life without family for 44 years and raise my children without family on their mother's side. It is my friends that have become my family. They have kept me sane. They have kept me connected. They have reminded me of my worth when I felt rubbish. They have done everything that one would expect a loving, supportive family to do. So that for me is really important. And that is the one thing that I could not live without.
Amen to that. And very finally, Jasvinda, what's one thing about you that would surprise people to know?
I really thought about this, and I know we've touched on it quite a lot, but I've never shared this before, but I will share it now because I think it's really important to share, is that I acknowledge that I have suffered with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, depression was an ugly word. It was a word that we were not allowed to use because of the expectations placed on us. So for me, the fact that I recognised in 2018, that long ago, in terms of my journey, 25 years later, I recognised that trauma had happened in my life. I didn't even use the word trauma. Trauma, what, me? No, that's somebody else, not me. You know, and I deal with people to support them, but they didn't happen to me. The fact that I acknowledged it and I have had support around it, I can recognize the flashbacks in terms of the anxiety and how I was responding to it. You know, you see a strong woman, but behind every strong woman, there's lots of things that are going on in that person's life. There's this expectation of you to be strong. You know, where do strong women go? And I meet myself now, and I'm okay with that because I've developed so many strategies and understanding around it that it's something that I found hard to accept myself. So I swim in cold seas. I do all sorts of things. I welcome it now. And I actually recognize it as something that is your body's telling you that, do you know what? These things have happened in your life, somewhere in your brain, this stuff is stored. You need to get it out, clean yourself, look after yourself. So it's part of that journey. But I've never admitted that, and I admit it here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that wonderfully memorable conversation, for all those wonderfully powerful, honest things that you've told us and shared with us. It has been an absolute delight and an honor to talk to you. And I'm so glad that we've been able to catch up and follow up on your incredibly well-deserved award. Thank you for all you've done and all I'm sure you will do in the future. Jasvinda Sangera, thank you.
Thank you.
The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. CCEP is the world's largest independent bottler. In Great Britain, they make, move and sell soft drinks for every occasion and employ some 3,600 people across England, Scotland and Wales at manufacturing sites, offices and depots. At CCEP, their everyone's welcome philosophy means they're creating a modern company where everyone can grow, develop and belong. They make a positive difference in both their workplaces and their local communities, which is something they're extremely passionate about at CCEP. If you've enjoyed this episode of The Extraordinary Ordinary, which of course we really hope you have, please rate and review us. It helps people to find us. Thank you.